everybody. Wowee! We are back, Beyond the Matrix, with you today. Woo-hoo! I know you're waiting and excited for the show today if you've been following my promo, because I'm delighted to bring you some very exciting information. Someone who is really well-known in our communities, and I've had the pleasure of meeting him recently. I'm talking about Lloyd Pye, who is renowned for his work with the Star Child skull, among other things. And we are predominantly going to be talking about the skull today, because he's told me he's going to divulge some exciting new breakthrough information on the show. And that is what you call having a scoop. So I'm excited. I met Lloyd Pye, last summer. And we were both speakers at an ET conference in, where was it, Madrid?
Right.
And he had, he had a copy of the skull there, and it was very exciting. So without too much further ado, other than just to give you a quickie about him, we're going to bring him in. As you can see, he's already piped up. He wants to talk. So let me just tell you, Lloyd is an author and a researcher, and he's, as I said, widely known for the Star Child skull. He's also known for his best-selling nonfiction book, Everything You Know Is Wrong. I love that one. So he's been involved with this for quite a while, and I am intrigued and delighted to bring him on. Hiya, Lloyd.
Hi, Pat. Thanks for having me on. It's a real pleasure to be with you, and the timing of this is absolutely exquisite because, as you referred to, we just yesterday released the new information onto the website that we'll be talking about today. So it's perfect timing. Your audience is the first in the world that will be hearing about this. So it's pretty exciting.
Well, that is such an honor. So whoever is listening, just know that you're right in the zone for picking up the latest scoop from Lloyd and this exciting information. So Lloyd, just to be putting everybody on the same page, let's assume there are people that are listening that don't exactly know what the Star Child skull is. So can you give us a very quick brief background on how it was found back in northern Mexico, 1930? And I'd like you to just touch on that and how you came into possession of the skull.
Right. Well, the main thing to know about it is that it's a real, true bone skull. It isn't a crystal skull. It's not knitted together from other pieces. It's a standard human-like skull, but it's not human because it has 25 major physical differences all in the same skull that are completely different from human, or very different from human. So there's really nothing of human left in it, actually. So it's clearly from day one of our awareness of it, which was back in February of 99, it was clear that from a physical standpoint, it was radically different. As you said, it was found in about 1930 by a woman exploring a mine tunnel down there, and she found a human skeleton and this small, what she called, misshapen skeleton. And she ended up recovering both skulls, although they received some damage over the years, but basically the skulls are there, and you can compare the two. They both have been carbon dated as having died about the same time, 900 plus or minus 40 years ago. So we say they're 900 years old. They died 900 years ago together. So when she brought them back to the States, she just considered them souvenirs, kept them her whole life, died in the early 90s, passed them on. They got passed on again, and they ended up with a couple in El Paso, Texas, named Ray and Melanie Young. Now, Melanie had been a neonatal nurse for about 15 years, and she knew right away this was not a typical human deformity skull. It was too light, much too light. It was too symmetrical, much too symmetrical. It just didn't look like deformity to her, but it also didn't look like a human skull. She and her husband, Ray, were members of El Paso MUFON, and to the MUFON group, it looked like the skull that would fit perfectly inside the head of a prototypical gray alien, because those are, everybody should know what that looks like. It's about 4 feet tall. They have bulbous top crowns on their head, but with a crease down the middle. They have very narrow, pinched lower faces, giving them what's called a heart-shaped face. And that
what you referred to as Whitley Schreiber's book cover.
Exactly. Whitley's cover, though, is an artistic representation, and though it has become the iconic image of a gray alien, that's not really what they look like. They have a little smoother, rounder, less threatening face than that, much more like the depictions of the Star Child that you can see on the website or in the e-book. That have been created by a guy named Rob Roy Menzies from Alaska. He did probably, I think, the best representations, although Bill Munns, a forensic sculptor, did a pretty good job for the TV show Monster Quest when we were featured on that show. So there are some images out there of the Star Child on the website and, again, in the ebook that people can see and judge, you know, what it might have looked like, and I think probably the Menzies depiction of it is as close as we've got to how it might have looked.
And, you know, it's really synchronistic, because I recently watched the movie, what is it called? I think Intruders, yeah, where we've got a film regarding alien abduction, and a lot of it is based on Bob Mack's many experiences with abductees. And the movie shows the same thing, a woman having her baby removed and then going out onto a craft and being introduced to her child, a Star Child, which I see on your site, that image.
Right. Well, that is a common story that a lot of women around the world tell, of being abducted, of being made pregnant, of being harvested in the fourth month, and then some years later being taken back on board a craft and being shown a hybrid offspring that they're told is theirs, and they're given a chance to bond with it. And most of them come away from that experience believing that it is theirs, in fact. So I have one lady, Josie Galante from New Mexico, on my site. I have her pictures because she was an artist, and she drew them after her experience, but before the Star Child came out, so that there was really no chance of overlap there. So I highlight her on the website and in the ebook as well.
So, okay, so we do know that despite your scientific research, you are definitely in the groove with the idea of, besides the proof that you present now with the skull, of all things, let's say, alternative when it comes to life beyond planet Earth.
Oh, yes, I'm totally in the groove with that. I don't think there's any doubt of it. I think we're visited on a regular basis. I believe in UFOs. I do believe that we are people, you know, those of us are abducted. Not everyone that says they are, obviously. Some people, of course, need attention for various reasons and make those kinds of things up. But most people who this happens to, they're not seeking attention. They're not trying to aggrandize in any way. And for most of them, it's a very upsetting and disturbing experience that they wish hadn't happened. So those, I think, tend to be, I think we can take them as at face value as legitimate.
Have you ever had an experience?
No, I've never been abducted. I did see a UFO once when I was about 28 years old. Clear day, no clouds in the sky out in California. A silver disc just ripping across the sky at incredible speeds. It covered 90 degrees of sky in about 10 minutes from literally straight up when my eyes caught it to the horizon in about 10 seconds. Must have been 20,000 miles an hour. I mean, and no question it was a silver disc. And I had great eyes then, and just no doubt I saw a UFO, you know. And I had two people with me, so we all saw it, and there was just no doubt.
So how is it you came into contact and eventually became the guardian of this important archaeological...
Well, to get back to that story, so Ray and Melanie in their MUFON group, and they were going over it, they said, well, look, how do we get this thing analyzed? And so one of the members had seen me give a lecture which at that time I was dealing with only human origins and hominoids, which is Bigfoot and the Abominable Snowman and all that. And so I had in that lecture, I dealt a lot with skulls, the skulls of prehumans, and showed how I think the ancestors that are called ours, the so-called prehumans, are in fact not ours. They don't look anything like us. They are, in fact, the ancestors of today's living hominoids. So, but the problem with that is it takes humans off the flowchart of life on Earth, and that's why hominoids are relegated to, you know, the back areas of most people's minds, because the mainstream can't really afford to deal with that idea. Same thing with aliens and UFOs. Any of that is going to take humans out of the flowchart of life on Earth. We didn't evolve here, so how did we get here? And therefore, Darwin begins to look shaky. It just messes up life for science, for government, for religion, and so they do all they can to keep this information, if not forbidden, at least on the back burners and out of the sight of most people, and you know, so that's how it works. So in dealing with trying to put my message out there, I had a lot of skull work, and so someone said, there's a guy named Lloyd Pye that deals with skulls. You might want to contact him. So I was living in New Orleans, so they said, next time you swing by El Paso, come by, we have something we'd like to show you. And I said, sure, I had no problem with that. So the next time, a couple months later, I swung by, and they showed them to me, and I was, of course, very impressed with the unusual one at the time, we called it, and it came to be known as the Star Child. And so they said, we'll take it with you and take it around and try to find out what it is, and we'll trust you with it. And I said, well, great, I'll do that. I said, should have an answer for you in maybe 6 months at the max. This is pretty interesting. Science should jump all over this, and here we are 12 years later.
Science is not jumping.
Science did not jump. I badly misunderstood the level of resistance that there is to things that are truly powerfully indicative of a major change. Science does not like major change. They're okay with little bitty incremental steps forward, but anything that looks like a big change, nobody wants to be in charge when something like that happens.
At least a big change that will question human history.
Exactly. Well, those,
they
you know, don't
see ever moving forward with technology that dramatically alters the future. It's the past they seem to have a problem with.
Exactly. Anything by definition that's going to cause them to have to reevaluate any major chunk of their understanding of their knowledge base is something they're going to avoid to the last possible moment if they can.
So what does your work entail? Besides, I know you're going to give us some exciting news about what you've discovered, but as far as your work with the Star Child and trying to bring this into the foreground of our knowledge, what are you doing? What has been the quest here?
We've had a lot of scientific tests conducted on it, from X-rays, CAT scans, biomolecular work, scanning electron microscope. You name it, what we could get done, what we could find people willing to do, what we could afford, we had done. But we found out pretty quick that anything in the realm of physical comparisons, biochemical comparisons, things like that, it just wasn't going to cut it, because every time we came up with something really unusual, the mainstream would just say, ah, well, nature can do that. Nature can do anything. No problem. Anything we can't explain, anything that looks unusual, it's not really a problem, because nature can do anything. Science uses nature the way religion uses God. Most people aren't aware of that, but that's what they do. Anything that can't be explained religiously, well, God, in his infinite wisdom or whatever, can do anything. So science uses nature as that kind of blunt weapon against anything they don't like, anything they don't agree with, anything they can't explain. Well, it's just no problem. Nature can do it. The one thing they can't really apply that to is DNA, because DNA is the math of biology, or the biology of math, however you want to look at it. But genetics is very precise and very consistent and very repeatable. It has all the things that science wants, and it's just undeniable. So it's kind of their weapon of choice. If it comes down to it in any kind of a crime, DNA rules over any amount of eyewitnesses you can come up with, over any other kind of circumstantial evidence. If the DNA says you did it, you did it. If the DNA says you didn't, and nobody even second guesses it. So that's the way it is. And that being the case, we were just very, very fortunate in that the Star Child had been buried in a mine tunnel for its 900 years. So its DNA was very well preserved, all things considered, for 900 years old. I mean, they're pulling DNA out of Neanderthal fossilized bones now. I mean, that's how good they are. So it isn't like we can't get this DNA out anymore. It was difficulty in 99, but not in 2003, but there was difficulty in getting it fine enough in 2003. Now they have the ability with the 454 technology and the Illumina technology and things like this, they can take unknown genomes apart down to the base pair nucleotide level, which is the basic building blocks. I mean, it's like taking a building, looking at the building, and disassembling it down to every single brick. Every brick in the building, you can figure it out, what it is, how it fits with all the other bricks. So what they can do now is amazing, and that's what we have been striving for with the Star Child over the 12 years. We just gave up on the physical stuff. We presented an overwhelming case with physical differences, and nobody cared. I mean, the science just shrugged it right off. Not a problem. Nature can do all that. Nature can't do all that. I mean, it's a clear, blatant, screaming lie. Nature cannot do what you see in the Star Child physically. All those differences. When a child is born in a primitive society 900 years ago, or even today, let's say a child is born, one, problem in its head, in its cranium, not a problem. Two, not really a problem. Three, it gets to be a little tough. Four, okay, now we've got some serious operating we have to do, but still can survive. Five, six, seven, somewhere you draw the line, that kid's going to die. The Star Child's 25 major differences, and it came out fine, grew up to be an adult of some age, we don't know what. The Star Child's clearly not human from a physical standpoint, but we could not make a case there. But with the DNA, we've been focused on that for the most part of the past 12 years, trying to get DNA testing done, getting it done, then dealing with the effects of it, then trying to get more done. And, of course, it's very expensive, and an operation like ours is just always strapped for money, always.
So since you've been exploring the DNA for these last 12 years, what has come forward, and what is do you want to break right into your groundbreaking announcement?
Right. Well, in the first test that we had done back in 99, the Star Child's DNA being 900 years old, that qualifies it as what's called ancient DNA, anything over 50 years. When they do DNA testing on fresh DNA, like your blood, your hair, or semen after a crime or something like that, it's still fresh. It's there. It's easy to recover all of it. There's no degradation. There's no contamination or very little, and it's easy to weed that out. But over 50 years, it becomes much more difficult to handle and deal with. There's a lot of degradation, there's a lot of contamination, and dealing with those problems, those issues, was difficult. In 99, it was extremely difficult. So the testing that we had done in 99 was really basically a failure. The lab thought it had made a recovery after two failures. They thought they had a recovery. They tried again. They thought they had it again, but it turned out later in 2003 that they were wrong. They didn't have a recovery at all. They had contaminated everything. But in 2003, we finally got a true, and excuse me, I should have said that, and that test in 99 was not for ancient DNA. It was in a forensic lab, and the forensic lab was just hoping that the preservation would be such that it would be 900 years in a mine tunnel would somehow equate to be less than 50 years. and that they would be able to make a recovery. And the reason for that, by the way, I should throw in, was that there were only six labs in the world in 1999 that could do ancient DNA recovery, and none of them would touch the Star Child with a 10-foot pole because of the professional stigma that would be associated with fooling with something to do with UFOs or aliens. So, but in 2003, there were 24 labs that would do it, and we finally found one, Trace Genetics in California, run by two young guys who were just getting started, but they were very competent. They had worked on the Kennewick Man, and so those guys got a good recovery for that time, which was that the human found with the Star Child was a human, and she was female, no question about it, and that the Star Child's mitochondrial DNA, which comes down from your mother, was from a human, but its nuclear DNA, which comes from your mother and your father, was they were unable to recover it. So, in effect, that meant that the father was not human. If the father had been human too, then the nuclear DNA primers would have recovered it, and that would have been that, and we'd have gone home in 2003, and the Star Child would have just been a very weird anomaly. But as it turned out, the DNA of 2003 showed that the father, there was something at least wrong with the father. If the mother's mitochondrial DNA could be recovered, that meant she was there in the nuclear DNA, but it wasn't good enough. They weren't connected enough. There wasn't enough of her, enough of him to pick up with the primers, and so Dad was clearly not entirely human. So we had that to work on, but what we couldn't tell in 2003 was how far away the father was from human, and there was no way to do that. There was just no way to do that. The technology had not yet been invented. So we had to wait until 2006 when a company called 454 announced that they could then recover an entire genome, as I said, nucleotide by nucleotide, base pair by base pair, down to the bricks, down to the very basics of how it's all put together, and then they could tell us what the Star Child was. The problem was, because it was so new and so expensive and so cutting edge, each test of that nature was cost millions of dollars, which of course we didn't have, and nobody in science was going to put that up and bring bring that kind of heat down on themselves. So we just had to sit and wait for the price to come down, which it began to do.
Let me just question something before you go on. What costs $1 million in a laboratory test? I don't understand that.
Well, with ancient old degraded DNA, like with the Neanderthal or with the Star Child or anything like that, you have to run the whole thing through numerous times to get a nuclear DNA, to get a genome, and that's all the nuclear DNA. What we're talking about, Pat, are 3 billion base pairs, 3 billion sequences of base pairs or nucleotides strung together. 3 billion is a very big number. So you have to do that numerous times to weed out the bacteria and and the mistakes in reading and just the fractures, the degradation within the pieces. So in one run, you'll get a piece here, a piece here, a piece here, a piece here, a piece here. Next run, you get a piece here, a piece here, a piece here, a piece here, and you have computers that begin to overlap them. So over time, 20, 30, 50, however many runs you do, you get your, however badly degraded it is, and the Neanderthal is very badly degraded, the Star Child's not really badly degraded at all. So the Star Child, when it gets its turn with the 454 machines, it will have to go through maybe 10 or 20 times, maybe 30 at the max, and all of it will be done. Now, these machines recover millions, literally tens of millions, of base pairs at a run, and a run takes, I think, a day with a 454 machine, I think 24 hours. But anyway, it takes a few weeks to do one run. So you see what it is. It's manpower, it's machine power, it's time.
Sure.
And when it all adds up, when it's all said and done, it's expensive. Now, if it's a fresh genome, if you go out and you kill an animal, you don't know what it is, you've never seen it before, and you bring some of its blood in, well, they're not going to have to do 20 or 30 or 40 times. They're just going to do, you know, one or two or three just to be sure everything is what it's supposed to be, and that's it, so it won't be as expensive. But something like the Star Child will be, and something like the Neanderthal is and has been. Neanderthal's probably, in the 5 years they've been working on it, it's probably up to around $30 million now. So it's very expensive, but we can get ours done. We can get what we need done for a couple of million. So that's really not bad, because, and the reason for that is you have two parts of the process. You have to recover the parts of the genome first, and then you have to read them. You have to know what you have. If everything in the Star Child was human, it wouldn't be a problem, because all the human genome is already known. It's in the databases, and you just put it in. And in fact, when you put Star Child DNA in now, little fragments, when you put little fragments of the Star Child in, it will come back as part of it is human-like. It will come back registering as we found something like this in human human chromosome number 1 or number 8 or number 7 or whatever. So that's known. The problem with the Star Child is a big chunk of its DNA, as much as 10% to 50% is never going to have been seen before on Earth, or at least not be in our databases. So it's going to have to be figured out base pair by base pair, the same way the original Human Genome Project was done, base pair by base pair. How does it all fit together? It's like putting a bunch of puzzle pieces on a table and having to assemble it. You know kind of what the picture is supposed to look like, but you're not sure how it all fits together. And so our team of geneticists is going to be up against a real challenge. And to be honest with you, a couple of million dollars is a bargain for what they have to do. But they, you know, like anybody with any sense, they want to be involved. I mean, this is a historic thing, and Pat, that takes the time to understand this, to look into it, to research it at any level, they come to understand, whoa, this is the real thing. This is really happening, and it's going to be historic, and they want to be a part of it. So we've got a good team lined up. They're just waiting for the money, really.
So what is the big breakthrough that you're announcing? You were starting, before I questioned you, you were saying that we waited for it to cost less, and for the price to come down. Have you had that breakthrough that you were looking for?
No. It didn't go like, it hasn't gone like that. The price coming down to, like, you know, a half a million for a, or 250,000 to a half million for a nice clean one, fresh one, that's still pretty high, but we could probably have raised that if that would have done the job for us, but it turns out that it won't, because so much of it is turning out to be unknown. But what happened was, early part of last year, January of last year, a miracle, just an absolute miracle out of the blue, a guy contacted me who was a geneticist at a major lab, the head of a major lab here in the States. And he said, you know, I heard about this thing and I thought it was, you know, just silly, and I just didn't pay any attention to it. And then a friend of my wife heard about it, and she got your ebook and she read it, and she thought you were legitimate, and so she convinced my wife, and my wife read it, and she convinced me, and I took a look, and he says, you know, I think you really could have something here. So if you will send me a sample, I can use some sophisticated recovery techniques that will at least tell you if the Star Child's nuclear DNA is there and viable. And he says, and once you know that, then you should be able to raise the money to get the whole thing sequenced, if it's viable. So I said, okay, great. So sent him the samples of the Star Child bone and the human bone. And he says, I'll get to it, you know, as I'm able in my spare time, kind of out of his own pocket, just to see what the answer would be, because he was curious. So a few weeks later, I get an email from him that says, hang on, Dorothy, Kansas is going bye-bye. And so I thought, uh-oh, we got something here. So I gave him a call, and he says, well, you really won't believe what we're finding here. Now, what he did was, now again, this is a year ago. This is the early part of last year. Not the new one. I'm bringing you up to speed here. So
that's right. We like all miracles. We want to hear about them all.
Okay. So last year, what he did was he recovered some fragments and isolated. Now there are programs that isolate out the bacteria. They recognize the bacteria, what it looks like. So isolated out the bacteria, got what he knew was Star Child fragments. And he got a few dozen of them, and he sent them to the NIH database. Now, the NIH is the National Institutes of Health, and they are the outfit in the States that sort of pay the money to do the research for science. They have like a $30 billion a year budget. They're this enormous outfit in the Washington, D.C. area, just one of the big, big chunks of government, the NIH. So they have maintained, wherever they give money to something to recover a genome, when that genome is done or any part of it, that goes back into their big database. It's public knowledge. The people that got the money are obligated to tell them what the results are. So they have, over the years, over the past 6 years since, or 5 years since the 454 machines and others have come online, literally tens of thousands of reports have gone in on like 150 species types and thousands of samples of living things on the earth. If it's on the earth, it's got a representative in that database. So he sent the Star Child's fragment pieces in there, its nuclear DNA in there, to see what it had to say about them, and some of them did come back saying it's human, no question. We this string of base pairs, 300, say 70, 75 base pairs long, has a perfect analog on chromosome 1 at such and such a spot, and I mean, it's all very precise. Okay, but a bunch of them came back saying no significant similarity found. No significant similarity found in the whole database. So what that meant was not found on Earth. So Kansas was indeed going bye-bye. So right there, that was a very big story for us. And so we started putting the word out, hey, we've got it. We've got what we really need here. The mainstream came back right away and said, well, wait a minute. You can't make that claim. Now, first of all, understand, too, we can't say who our geneticist is, who the lab is, where he works for, because the real conservative hawks among the mainstream, they'll have his job in no time. They'll just absolutely harass him out of his job, because wow. You can't be in the mainstream and help people who are doing research on UFOs or aliens or Bigfoot, any of the big no-nos, cold fusion, the electric universe theory. You can't do any of that, or you're in trouble with your leadership. So, we tell everybody the same thing. Everybody that's ever worked for us, the deal is you don't say who we are until we're ready to report a peer-reviewed report, a peer-reviewable report, something that'll stand up. So, we've made that agreement with him, not a problem, but it causes difficulties in that it allows the mainstream to pick away at us by saying, oh, well, you could just be making all this up.
Inventing this and you have no proof.
Yeah,
it's like a catch-22 situation.
Right, but what they said in terms of what the first report was, hey, you can adjust those filters on the NIH, on the NIH program to be the tightest possible parameters you can get, and so things will be excluded if you do that. Well, of course, our guy was very careful to set it on the very loosest parameter possible, which is any significant similarity, not an exact match. He didn't send them in saying, find me exact matches. He sent them in saying, find me approximate, as close as, in the general vicinity. If several of them match up, that's close enough. And a lot of them came back, no significant similarities found. So he did it right, but they can say and pretend that he didn't, that if he's finding an answer that they don't agree with, he must be cheating. But he didn't. So that pretty much left us at a stalemate there, and there wasn't a lot we could do. So we just kind of floated along through the year trying to raise the money and have, you saw me when we met in Madrid. That's what I was trying to do, make people aware, hey, we have this. We have the ability here if we can just get the money. And it didn't turn out. So it's a hard thing to sell an investor on when you have anybody that they check for information is going to say, oh, no, that can't be true. We know that can't be true because we've been told that isn't true by people who are supposed to know. So it's you get an investor sort of interested. They'll take a little bit of a look, but they'll go talk to people they know that they trust as scientists, or they'll look you up on Wikipedia. I mean, if nothing else, they'll look you up on Wikipedia. And there is nothing we can do to get those ridiculous stories about the Star Child and about me on Wikipedia to change. Those kinds of alternative stories, most people aren't aware of this, but when it comes to alternative knowledge, anything that's on Wikipedia is going to be a lie, because they are an absolute tool of the mainstream. Wikipedia is a mainstream toady, run by mainstream toadies for mainstream toadies. So they do not let the truth about anything alternative in there. So if you want to read the Wikipedia articles about either the Star Child or me, go to the website starchildproject.com or lloydpye.com, and I have those articles word for word, but underneath each of their lies and misstatements and fabrications, I have the truth, so you can at least find out the truth.
Why, Lloyd, what are they saying about you, little darling?
Oh, just go read it. It's just, you know, that I don't know my head from a hole in the ground, and, you know, things like that. And that the Star Child has been proven since 99 to be a human male. Remember the first test, the Canadian test, that they didn't really know what they were doing. It was run by students at a dental forensic lab in Canada. It was just the worst kind of disaster, but it gave them the answer they wanted, which was that it was a human male. And to this day, till 2011, science sits on that answer as being the correct one, even though it's been proven miserably wrong by two rounds of DNA testing. But science just doesn't want to hear the new answers, and so they just cling to the old answers. So that's what you'll find highlighted in the Wikipedia article. But anyway,
I'm reminded of the Akhenaten debate of the Pharaoh Akhenaten, who is so clearly of an alien. I'm not suggesting that I know for sure, because I am no scientist, but it doesn't take much to look at that of the depictions of Akhenaten and not understand that the skull was completely diverse from a human skull, and so were the skulls of his children. So we start hearing all these stories in mainstream archaeology about how he was deformed and he had this disease that caused his fingers to be extra long and all this nonsense. And I mean, you look at those skulls and it's like, there's proof here.
Well, you know, mainstream Egyptology is no different than any form of mainstream science. It's just
full
of malarkey because they're defending positions.
Exactly.
Mainstream Egyptology has its positions that it has to defend, so that anything that comes up that contradicts that, they have to find ways to do away with it. So same thing with what the problem we face with the Star Child is, we're constantly dealing with the battle. It's a real competition because they stand to lose something, which is a lot of credibility, which is having to go back to the drawing boards, which is having to, you know, discard a lot of their what they consider truth and basic fact and all that, and it really makes them look stupid and bad and incompetent, which they will fight till the very end when there's no way, you know, they can avoid accepting that. So,
not to mention, of course, the fact that the managers of planet Earth do not want us to embrace the idea that there have been or there are alien life forms on this planet, which is pretty ridiculous.
Well, I don't think they want to do it until they have to, but I you know, they don't really have too much of a choice, I don't think, with the Star Child now, because it's so you know, knowledge about it is so widespread, pieces of it are scattered around. It's pretty much the cat's out of the bag, the horse is out of the barn. So I don't know what they can do except just, it's the standard thing, Pat, you know as well as I do. It's ignore as long as possible, then ridicule as much as possible, and then destroy the messenger rather than the message as much as possible, and hope that that'll do the job. And so,
yes, this is very timely. I well know what you're talking about.
Exactly, man. That's just the standard routine, and the reason that they use it is because it works. It's over time been shown to work again and again and again because most people don't really bother to look under or beyond what their leadership of science tells them, or government or religion. The leadership says this, okay, I'm going to believe it. I'm not going to bother myself. I'm going to, you know, just keep watching my TV, go to my job, do my, you know, play my golf and not worry about it. So it's only for a select few people who are really looking for more, looking for other answers, alternative answers that really dig into it. And that's hopefully the majority of your audience will be that way.
It's definitely the majority of my audience, and hopefully it will be growing numbers of the population, because in case anyone hasn't been looking, we urgently need alternative answers to our earthly civilization and questions about the past and projections into the future. So, yeah, you've got a captive audience.
I think that the new stuff we have with the Star Child is going to be really a linchpin for moving us in that direction, because I think it's the kind of lever that can provide a tipping point pressure in that direction. So it's pretty exciting. Let me get on to the new stuff so everybody, you know, so the story is we had all that information, but we couldn't get it past the mainstream gatekeepers because they just said, oh, you fiddled with the dials and, you know, we don't have to listen to that. It's kind of like God can do anything. It's just we were hamstrung. We were thwarted. So the geneticist began to look at other things, ways to go about it, again, without money. This is just sort of out of his own pocket, out of his own time. We don't have a lot of money to put into this. So he checked the mitochondrial DNA, which back in 2003, the geneticist found was human. So we've just been assuming all along it was human. Early this year, early in January, he took a look at the mitochondrial DNA and ran it through, and guess what? Guess what? It came back not human. Not human at all. Now, I know it's a big story. Now, here's what happened. Here's where it really... Now, for those of you who now are interested in this and want to know more about it, on the website StarChildProject.com, www.StarChildProject.com, just yesterday, we posted the latest mitochondrial DNA results in a report that unfortunately has to be in a certain degree of scientific language. It has to be exactly right so that it can pass scientific muster, but we've also written it as best we can so that ordinary people can understand it, so don't be intimidated, and there are plenty of photos and illustrations and graphs and charts. So
yeah,
it's
very effective.
You'll come out of it, you understanding it. So what it was mitochondrial DNA. Now let's understand the difference of what we're talking about here. In most every cell in your body, let's just say every cell in your body, because it's most of them except the red blood cells. In every cell of your body, you have a nucleus, and inside the nucleus is all of the genetic package that your mother and father gave you. That is all 23 chromosomes from mom, all 23 chromosomes from dad, 46 chromosomes total. All of that wadded up like just a tight wad of rubber bands, these strings of chromosomes, in the nucleus of every cell. It's just so incredible how this works, of every cell. And so there it is, floating outside the nucleus, but still within the cell, in the cytoplasm, are little bitty chips, little like, imagine little marbles or little golf balls, floating around, brown things, and they are the mitochondria. Now, mitochondria are very, very different than the nucleus, but they both have DNA and they both have genomes. The nuclear genome is 3 billion plus base pairs long in humans. 3 billion plus. But the mitochondrial genome is exactly 559 nucleotides or base pairs long. 16,569. All of us have that many. It's very precise, so it's very well understood. And more than that, it is one of the most conserved parts of human biology. and one of the best understood, because it's just so small relative to the 3 billion one. And they've been working with it for since the 80s, I think, breaking it down into its pieces and understanding it. They understand every variation that exists within humans in the mitochondria. Why? Because there's no waste in it. There's just very little junk. In the nuclear DNA, most of it is junk DNA. We don't even know what it does. It just sort of sits there, but it's not really active. Like 95% of it is junk. But in the mitochondrial DNA, then they call it junk. Exactly. They call it junk. So, but in the mitochondria, most of it is busy all the time. It's the power plant of your cells, and so it's busy all the time, so all of it works, all of it functions. And anything that goes wrong in it, any mutation or anything that's negative creates, it's just like throwing a wrench in the gears, and it just grinds to a halt, and that mutation, the person with that's going to die, dysfunction and die. So what's in mitochondria is a very clean machine, very clean working, and very, very few variations are allowed. Now, we humans are now divided into, you can get different numbers of haplogroups, but basically they work with 33 haplogroups of humans. All right, that's all of us. Within those 33, there are about 120 variations are possible. Only 120 variations that are known and accepted in all 16,569, 120 variations maximum. You with me? Now, yeah. with the star child, the geneticist pulled out fragments of its mitochondrial DNA and checked them out and found that they had many, many more, changes, variations, differences than humans have. It can't be a human. In the report that's on the website, we have one that we focus on. In the new ebook, the new version of the ebook that's on the website as well, we focus on four of these fragments, because they're just all different from different areas of the genome, of the mitochondrial genome. But the first one, the one that we focus on in the report, is because it's the shortest, the smallest, the cleanest, the easiest to see and understand. It's only 167. Nucleotides, base pairs long, 167 out of the 16,000, So 167 long, and when you match that up with its analog in the human mitochondrial genome in the same area, among all humans, among the 33 human haplogroups, there is one recorded variation, one recorded difference in one haplogroup. It's a very, very conserved area of the human mitochondrial genome. Very important, very conserved. One change. In the star child, in that same stretch, there are 17 differences. Wow. Now, science will argue, some of those 17 might not stay. with repeated tries, it may not, and that's true. If you were to sequence that over several times, it could be that a few or more of those 17 will not stick as variations. The vast majority of them will. Anybody that's in genetics knows that. You can quibble that a few might go down and turn out to be not just mistakes of the reading process, because the readers, the machines that do the reading, are not exactly perfect. But they're generally very good. And so all you need is just, to do them a few times over again. But that's going to stick. So in the four that I'm talking about that are in the ebook that you can look at and analyze and study in the ebook, in those four, the total amount of base pairs instead of 167 in the one is 1,700. We go all the way up to 1,700 because the other three are much larger than that 167. Again, the 167 was the shortest. The others are 400 or 500 like that. So you were up to 1,700 base pairs of the 16,000, so roughly 10%. In those 1,700, in just four fragments, we have 91 differences, 91. Now, if you were to be extremely conservative and say, of those 91, only, let's say, 60, only two-thirds, are going to actually stay there. It's going to be more, but let's just say, to be very conservative, 60 are going to stay, right? So you extrapolate that by the 10 times, it's 10% is 10 times, that would be 600 differences in the star child over the whole 16,500 and however many the star child is going to have, because it may have a different number, probably will have a different number than human, because it's clearly not human. So whatever it's going to be, it's going to be vastly more than the humans 120. So really, Pat, we've got it here. We absolutely have this in the bag, as well as you can make history in the bag. As I said in the recent Bite of Pie, for those who are on my mailing list, I started off by saying this: imagine you're with Columbus. Imagine that you're with Columbus on the first voyage, and you hove into the sight of the land of the New World. It's for real. Columbus wasn't crazy. There you are. You're looking at it. And yet it's too late in the day. You can't really go ashore. You batten down the hatches, and you're going to ride out the night, and you're going to explore it the next day. But that night, a heavy storm comes in, and it blows for days, and it blows to the east, and it blows you out to the middle of the Atlantic. So let's just go on back to Spain. We're going to get more money. We're going to get more ships. We're going to come back, and we're going to tackle this place, right? Okay. So yeah. That's exactly where we are. We see the land. We can see the land. We have to get the whole genome to get out there and understand what the size of it is, how wide it is, how long it is. We need all that. But we've seen the edge of the land. It's there.
You have seen the promised land, as they say.
We've seen the promised land, and that's it.
So now
we find ourselves really just needing the money. We're now looking for that special individual who both has money and has an interest in this sort of thing and wants to join us, you know, hopefully standing on the stage at the Academy Awards accepting the best Oscar for a documentary film of 2012. I mean, that's really where we are right now.
And who has the moxie to stand up to the conservative scientific community. And
well, you know, we could keep them anonymous if they wanted to be. I mean, that's not really an issue. But we want somebody who has the same kind of sensitivity about this that we do. Obviously, you know, we're doing something very, very special. This is going to be as historic as Columbus or landing on the moon or any of that. This is really of that scale. And we need somebody involved in that over the next, you know, couple of years, which is what we're talking about, to make two documentaries, which is what we're going to do. I mean, the reason is we have to film everything our guys do. We can't just do this and give a result. We have to have film footage of everything, or the mainstream won't accept it. So if we have to film it anyway, we might as well make a couple of documentaries about it as a historical record, but because everybody in the world's going to want to know how it happened, or what's the story behind it. So we're in a perfect position to create two very worldwide successful films for not a lot of money, relatively speaking. I mean, everybody, like I said, everybody that's involved in this is giving us cut-rate prices just because they want to be involved in it. It's history. You'd have to be a moron.
Hold on. What do you need to create financially?
We need the total tab we need is $7 million U.S. Yeah. Well, the problem is that, again, we have a couple million costs in the testing, and we have a couple million more in the filming. So, you know, there's just no way around it. And $2.5 to $3 million when you add in, extras, when you add in cushions, when you add in salaries, insurance. Are you there?
Yep.
Oh, it sounded like that had fallen off. So when you add in all the extra things, that's what it comes out to, $7 million. Yeah, I know.
Let me say this.
There, you and I know perfectly well there are a lot of people in this world that go out and lose that much on a bad drunken weekend at Vegas or Monaco. This is not stopper. The amount of it is large, yes, but to a lot of people out there, it's chicken feed. So we just have to get our story in front of that kind of person, but also have that kind of person have the kind of sensibilities we do about finding the truth and wanting to find it out. They're out there. We just, somebody's got to help us get the word to them, and that's what we're trying to do is tell anybody if they know how to personally get in touch. See, the problem is we can't get past their gatekeepers. They hire people to keep people like us away from their boss. So it's got to be a friend of a friend, somebody that can personally talk to them about
it. A miracle.
A miracle. That's what we need.
All right,
but we've had several. Hey, look, we've had...
out of time, so I send out that request for a miracle for Loy so that we can finally bring the truth of alien presence and past and all the glory of what that means from the scientific point of view out to the world. So if you're a millionaire listening to my show, first of all, let me know who you are, because funding's needed everywhere. And secondly, please tune in to Lloyd Pye. His websites are starchildproject.com. You can also check him out on lloydpye.com. Lloyd, you're great. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Pat. It's been a real pleasure being on the show. And just keep doing what you're doing and grow your audience.
You too, my brother. All right, there goes Lloyd. Before I sign out, I would like to just announce that I found out today that the great Mayan record keeper, Jose Arguelles, has passed to the other side. I don't want to be sad. He told his lovely partner, who I've had the pleasure of meeting, Stephanie South, I'll be working from the other side and helping things progress. So thank you, Jose, for all you gave to humanity and all you will continue to do on the other side of the rainbow. Folks, this is Patricia Corey. I'm sending you love. Love to Lloyd and the Star Child Skull. Come on, universe, send him down his investor and let's get this story cracking. Thank you, everybody. Remember, in April, I go on every other week. So please pay attention to my announcements so you can catch the show with wild and crazy people like Lloyd, all the amazing work that's going on, every kind of alternative thing I can throw at you. That's my job in Beyond the Matrix, in the free thought zone. I challenge you to think outside the box of convention. Nano, nano.